Welcome to this edition of Family Talk. I'm Lou Ann Crane here with Ryan Dobson. And of course, our host is psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And Ryan, today we're going to address a subject that really affects a lot of families, but isn't talked about very openly. And for that reason, this is a good time to let parents know that the topic is not for young ears. So if you have your children around, this would be a good time to occupy them elsewhere.
I think that's a good idea, Luann. The conversation we're going to hear today, my dad had some time ago with Dr. Arch Hart on the topic of male sexuality, and it is not often talked about in mixed company, and it's true today. You and I are going to step aside and let my dad and Dr. Hart talk about some of the issues and questions men have about their sexuality.
Well, Ryan, let me just give a little background on Dr. Hart. He's a longtime friend of your dad's, a native South African, which I personally appreciate because I lived there for 5 years.
That's right.
He holds a PhD in psychology and is the former dean of the School of Psychology at Fuller Theological Seminary. He's retired from teaching full-time, but he does continue to teach courses there in psychology, as well as, and this will not surprise you, this gentleman speaks around the world. He's published over 25 books, and one of them is what we will hear about today.
I actually heard him speak in person for the first time when I was in Australia.
Oh, it doesn't surprise me.
He was brilliant. The title of the book we're going to be hearing about today is called The Sexual Man, Masculinity Without Guilt. And there's a quote about the book, and it says, based on nationwide research, this groundbreaking report refutes the current myths surrounding male sexuality and offers a sane view of what it means to be a male, sexual, and normal.
As you can see, it's a pretty sober topic before us today. Let's go ahead and begin this Family Talk broadcast as Dr. Arch Hart explains why his study differs from so many others.
This is a Christian book. It's a book about the sexuality of Christian men. And most of the studies that have been done that in recent years that have looked at the sexuality of men have looked at the sexuality of the fringe maleness, trying to push back the boundaries. How far are we pushing back the boundaries of sexuality? I wanted to get back to the core.
Well, there have been some awful studies that have come out. The height report, which was just a joke. The Janus report was also flawed. The Kinsey report, which has now been debunked.
Yes.
Masters and Johnson, which was a little better, but that goes back to 1968. This is the first study that I'm aware of that did focus on Christians from a Christian perspective.
Yes. I studied what I call good men, and I wanted to know what is the state of their sexuality.
What did you find? What's the most salient point that came out of your study?
I think I would summarize it with the following, that having grown up in a Christian home is probably the best guarantee of an absolutely healthy, satisfying, and fulfilling sexual life.
The Janus report said the opposite.
The Janus report said the exact opposite.
That being a Christian somehow inhibits pleasure in
sexuality.
Absolutely.
That growing up in a Christian home distorts your sexuality, that something represses it or inhibits it or distorts it. And there is just absolutely no evidence for that. The best thing we can give our boys, because this is about men, and I hope maybe sometime in the future we'll focus on women. But for now, my concern is for men. And the greatest gift we can give our boys is to raise them in a really healthy Christian family.
I should have asked you to start with about the sample, about over what period of time, how you studied the men. Give us a little feel for the investigation.
I set out to gather as many responses as I can from good Christian men who are not out there abusing sexuality. These are married men. These are mainstream men. These are God-fearing men, church-going men. They desire to be good. They have the longing to be good. And I had hoped to get 1,000 men, but I ended up only with 600 because we had a deadline for the publishing. But what about the sample size? By the time I'd got 150 responses, I had pretty well nailed what it is to be a Christian man and sexual.
This was not a random sample.
No.
So therefore, it is not representative of the population at large.
It's a stratified sample.
Yes.
It's that way deliberately because I asked the question, how good does it get, first of all, and secondly, is it good enough? And there really are two messages that I'm sending in the book. The first message is a message of reassurance. I believe that Christian men today need reassurance that the way they are is perfectly normal. And I say that because there is a lot of guilt in good men about their sexuality.
Well, define normal sexuality for us from a Christian perspective.
From a Christian perspective, it's sexuality that is confined to the marital relationship. It is a sexuality that gives expression to the full hormonal forces that are at work, but at the same time has an appropriate set of boundaries and control. Mm-hmm. A normal sexuality, an uncontrolled sexuality, cannot be normal. And so we need to call men back to a sanctified sexuality. The way it is, even with good men, is just not good enough.
Even normal masculine sexuality from a Christian perspective is a pretty formidable force.
You know, as I've done many radio programs and talked to groups about this book, what amazes many of the women who read the book, and by the way, I advocate that couples read this book together.
Yes,
it's not a book you give to a man. No, no, I want couples to read it together, if for no other reason but to open up communication between the two of them. Hmm. But as I've talked to women, essentially, they are aghast at the realization that men 24 hours a day, many times every hour, have got only one thing on their mind.
Hey, I got to tell you a story. I'll probably get in trouble for telling this. This is absolutely true, but that doesn't make it any less dangerous. We have some friends who were water skiing, and the two women were riding in the boat, and one of their husbands was trying to learn to water ski out back, and he was having an awful time. He fell 12, 14 times. The guy was exhausted. He was drowning. He was blowing bubbles. And his wife looks back there at him and said, would you believe he'll probably want it when he gets home tonight?
Yeah, but that is a given, that the male sex drive is hormonally controlled, and it is a powerful force, and that means it has to be controlled. It can easily become distorted. It can become an abusive thing. And we in our Christian subculture need to begin talking about it more openly than we are and looking carefully at the way we are shaping the sexuality of our young boys.
Now, that is an extremely important point from my perspective, Arch. Because of the power of the sex drive and because of its recurrence in the thought process, guilt for a Christian man is almost inevitable because he does have thoughts that he can't mm-hmm. always control, and they're not always sanctified,
no.
Right?
That's right.
And so how commonly did you see in your analysis and in your study this element of guilt over things that were really beyond a man's control?
It's pervasive. It's throughout the whole study. Men are bothered by their sexuality. They don't know what normal is. They've lost a sense of, am I okay? That's the question I kept getting from them. Am I normal? Am I normal? Am I normal? And the main reason for that, and I this comes out in the book, in the study I've done, is that men don't talk about it mm-hmm. at all. Women talk about it all the time. Men never talk about sex or sexuality.
Yeah. Much less sexual problems.
And heaven forbid they should ever mention a sexual problem. So they carry this burden of concern and guilt, because that's what it is ultimately, about whether they're normal or not. And this is one of the main causes for the distortions that come about to their sexuality. That guilt is not a healthy thing. It's often the guilt associated with certain habits that men indulge in that leads to an addictive process because yes. it becomes obsessive compulsive. Yes. The guilt makes the relief they experience an even greater relief. It's the upper and downer phenomenon of all addictive behavior.
You know, when I was a kid, I came out of a pretty conservative church environment, which had a lot to say about sex and most of it negative. Mm-hmm. And what seemed to be taught to men without saying it directly was that any sexual arousal outside the confines of the marital bedroom was sin. I'm sure it was based on Jesus' words in Matthew 5, "He that looketh on a body of a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her in his heart already."
That's right.
I don't believe that that's the proper interpretation of that scripture, because if you can live without that, you're a man in a great deal of trouble.
You are a man in a lot of trouble. The fact that you have sexual thoughts, even toward another woman, in and of itself does not constitute lust. It's what you do with those thoughts. Do you foster them? Do you encourage them? Do you stay with them? To be tempted is not sin. It's whether you you do with the temptation.
Yes.
Even Jesus was tempted, as we are, but without sin.
Yes.
So that it is unrealistic, in my opinion, to expect good Christian men not to experience some temptation. But many of them out there believe that just because they are tempted, that somehow they've sinned, and in a strange way, that reaction sets them up for a fall that wouldn't be otherwise if they could just accept the fact, this is what it means to be a normal man, but I choose to set it aside. I choose not to focus on it. I choose to focus my my sexuality back where it belongs, on my
wife. Lust that Jesus was talking about occurs in the will, not in the hormonal response.
After, I mean, there is a...
It's a yielding to it.
A momentary surge of testosterone is not what lust is about. But perhaps one of the most critical issues that I believe my book draws attention to is the fact that it is becoming more and more difficult to teach young boys the foundations for self-control later, for several reasons. One of them being the fact that the age of puberty continues to drop. I mean, it alarms me. I have an 11-year-old grandson that is taller than I am, and is into puberty already. Yeah. When I was a teenager, at age 13, 14, maybe you reached puberty. And there's evidence now of sexual activity taking place in 11 and 12-year-olds. And the gap between reaching the age of puberty and the age at which you can legitimately fulfill your sex drive is getting wider and wider. The upper age is going up because of the delayed adolescence we're seeing. The bottom is going down for biological reasons. And that long period of waiting constitutes the most significant challenge we as Christians have to face in the years that lie ahead.
I remember from my own graduate work a study of Norwegian girls.
Yes.
In 1850,
I know that study.
The average age of the menarche, or the first menses, was 17.
That's right.
And now it's down below 12, or close to 12. Yeah. It was 12.5 last time I saw it.
I report in my book a study out of Central Africa where they're comparing rural girls with urban girls. And there's a 3-year age gap between rural girls in Africa and urban girls in Africa. And but there's also some evidence, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Jim, but there's some evidence that early exposure to erotic material in boys seems to spark an earlier production of hormones and maturing of sexuality. Kids are getting finding their dad's pornography at age 5, 6, 8 years of age, and in our society, they're 51% of the married men, the married good men in my study, 51% of them acknowledge that they are still continue to masturbate to pornography. I think it's our greatest secret sin, and it's pervasive throughout the church. I deal with many, many pastors, and please believe me, the last thing I want to do is pastor bash, or even male bash for that matter. But it's higher in non-pastors, but it is also very high amongst pastors. And it is an addiction. It is part of what I call the obsessive compulsive nature of male sexuality today. We are obsessed with it. And fathers who are into porn, who are into misuse of sex, in many, many subtle ways, that is being rubbed off, and that is being passed on in some way. So I think that perhaps the greatest reason a father can give himself for saying, I'm going to deal with my sexuality, is so that he can pass on a healthier sexuality to his son.
And kids do find that stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
You bring it into the house, they'll find it.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson, and we're listening to a recorded conversation between my dad, Dr. James Dobson, and our guest, Dr. Arch Hart, who wrote the book we're talking about, The Sexual Man, Masculinity Without Guilt. And we have that available at our website, which is familytalk.org, as well as the complete conversation you're listening to today, which will include tomorrow's discussion as well. If you'd like to stream this talk or download it for further listening, again, familytalk.org is the starting place. Once again, here's our host, Dr. James Dobson.
Arch, during the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, we studied the biochemical effects of pornography. Mm-hmm. And those images that you're talking about, those pornographic images, actually get imprinted into the brain by a release of epinephrine, a hormone that stamps them in, and they are with you more than the other images of your day.
Yes.
More than the things, you know, you go through a whole day. How many things do you see? How many things do you feel? Those are forgotten, but those pornographic images biochemically get actually locked into your brain, and you don't get away from them.
Yes, I think they make connections probably within the brain structure. And not only does epinephrine or adrenaline, which is the other label for epinephrine, do so in the brain, but our own adrenal systems, the little adrenal glands above the kidneys, become conditioned to respond to certain types of thrilling, unsavory, risky behavior. And I think that one of the most powerful forces that creates addictions in the sexual arena is the pairing of adrenaline arousal, as in doing something risky or risque, with sexual arousal, to the extent that men today, and this is also to do with how men think, men are thinking novelty. They want something new. They want some new experience to give them an adrenaline surge. It's a form of addiction that even good married men can succumb to extremely readily and easily.
Would you say that Christian men are particularly conflicted over sex, Arch?
I think they're conflicted because of the double messages they receive. I don't know that there's a lot of good teaching out there, what a good biblical understanding of the sex drive is concerned. For many of them, though, I think that they have been influenced by these outside forces, the cultural forces around us. And, you know, I empathize with young boys. I empathize with my 11-year-old grandson, who has all this testosterone now surging in his veins, who notices girls, who obviously, you know, is beginning to experience sexual arousal. He has got a long time to wait before he can give fulfillment to that. And we must not underestimate the seriousness of this problem.
Arch, does it bother you that for the most part, this is a generalization, but I believe it, for the most part, the church does not deal with this issue?
It bothers me greatly. I can tell you from my intensive work with many, many pastors that pastors are as troubled as any group of people, because for them, their desire to be a good man is greater than it is for anyone else. So their conflicts are greater because they stand in the pulpit, they preach a sermon, they look down, they see an attractive woman, they begin to experience sexual arousal even while they're preaching. And then there's nowhere they can go to talk about it. My study shows that barely one out of four men have someone they can talk to about their sexual feeling, sexuality, and that's their partner.
The last time you were here, we talked about another study that was done at Fuller. I don't know whether you incorporated it in this book. You said, as I recall, at 37% of pastors...
33%.
33% have had an inappropriate sexual
that's
relationship
right.
with a member of their present congregation.
Correct. Have what they consider to be an inappropriate sexual action. Now, how to interpret that, what does it include, what it doesn't include, we don't quite know because we made the mistake of not asking the more specific question. But some other studies since then have put the figure at somewhere between 12 and 20% of pastors have had intercourse with someone other than their spouse. And it is high.
How can you stand in the pulpit and preach the Word of God with that on your mind?
Well, that's the struggle that so many men are putting up with today. Hence my call in the book to re-examine our sexuality and to create, to intentionally create a healthier sexuality. It's better than it is in the non-Christian world. I mean, comforts me to know that good men are better than secular men. But on the other hand, I really have to conclude it's not good enough.
Christian men are part of the culture. The culture influences all of us, not just those who are outside the Christian perspective. We're all caught in that stream which carries you in the same direction. You just think of the number of young people today who are being swept up into that safe sex ideology, the kind of nonsense that's taught in many public schools today. And then those kids grow up with the scars of that kind of behavior very early in life.
And our preoccupation seems to be to protect these children. In other words, the best we can do is to dish out condoms to make sure that we reduce the pregnancy rate or the infection rate. But little real attention being given to shaping the sexual attitudes and feelings and the teaching of appropriate control to our young people, particularly our young boys.
What kind of church program would you like to see occur? Would you segregate it by sex?
Oh, absolutely.
And you would have who teach these classes?
You need to bring in someone who is a sensitive listener, who can draw, if you had a class of teenage boys around puberty, to draw out their feelings. Boys, so that when they become men, should be able to talk about their feelings associated with sexuality. I think the more they understand these feelings and can accept them, the healthier they can be later. For many men, sex becomes a biological act. It is disassociated with relationship. It is disassociated with intimacy. And the marked difference between how boys and girls operate in this regard is something that we in the church need to give more attention to and to talk more openly about.
Why don't you
about.
Summarize those differences in the waning moments here?
Well, the most important difference I see between male and female sexuality is that for many women, sex is a means to achieving a fulfilling relationship. Sex always has a secondary purpose in most normal women. It is a means for encouraging a closeness, a unity, a unifying, a bonding of the relationship. It's a means of drawing closer together. For men, sex is just a matter of release. It's a pent-up tension brought about mainly by the hormonal influences, and their drive to orgasm in males is so forceful. I mean, that's the only thing they're concerned about, that they can't enjoy the journey. And men really need to relearn how to experience a more fulfilling relationship sexually as the only way of achieving real fulfillment.
And that becomes extremely frustrating to women.
And it's the most significant cause of the tension that exists between men and women in our day and age.
Hmm. We want to talk about it some more next time. In fact, I'd like to get into some of the details for individuals, but kind of give us a preview of that. Does the book, would it address the couple that's having a sexual problem? Would it be of help to those who just have a pretty dead sex life?
This is not a manual. This is not a manual. It is a book that tries to get at the core issues that give rise to problems, and I hope that read together by men and women, dating couples even, but particularly married couples, it can begin to open up a deeper understanding of the complexity of male sexuality and what it takes to build a healthier sex life. I wouldn't want to go into marriage if I were a woman, if I did not understand some of the things that are expressed in my book.
We've been listening to Dr. Arch Hart on today's Family Talk broadcast with Dr. James Dobson. Ryan, Dr. Hart certainly has some great advice for both men and women.
Lou Annie does. It is amazing to me that in this day and age of such sexual pervasiveness, where it is all around us, most of that information is wrong. And clearly, men and women still have a lot to learn about the opposite sex, especially when it comes to physical intimacy. And I know this will be helpful to many people. And we will have the rest of this discussion tomorrow.
We will. In the meantime, if you would like to learn how to get a copy of Dr. Hart's book, the one that was discussed today, it's called The Sexual Man, Masculinity Without Guilt. Give us a call, 877-732-6825, 877-732-6825, or visit us online, familytalk.org. You can even ask for a CD copy of this two-day broadcast, what we began today and what we will continue tomorrow. Ryan, this reminder, we do make those available with our compliments, but there are costs associated with these resources. So anyone who's able to donate at this time, it would be greatly appreciated.
It would. And we're aware that this broadcast may have brought up some difficult feelings. And if anyone listening would like to speak to a counselor, let us know. We would be happy to assist you in finding one in your area. You can do so when you call us or when you visit our website and click the Find a Counselor link on our broadcast page. Again, that is familytalk.org.
Thanks for tuning in today, and we invite you back tomorrow as we hear the conclusion of this important discussion right here on Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson.